Look out!
Surging up from the depths of the sea.
Horrifying, mysterious creatures whose attack on people sends the whole countryside on an endless search.
And unless something is done, and done quickly.
Is this the end of our civilization?
You'll pioneer with us the perilous descent into the unknown.
Yeah, what does that mean? What are you even talking about?
A deep, penetrating dive.
In the last calm and reflective moment before the monsters came.
Humanoids from the deep dive.
Welcome to the podcast Humanoids from the Deep Dive, where we dig deep into the meanings and context of your favorite monsters and monster movies. Each episode will see guests, co-hosts, and myself give our take on an important movie, monster, and or film, and what we think it means, using everything from history and philosophy to films and folklore. Today we're doing another review minisode because there's so many movies coming out both in theaters and on streaming this week and a little bit beyond that, you know, frankly, couldn't help but cover. Some of them I'm very excited about, some of them are, you know, I'm a little less so. We'll be covering Ghostbusters Frozen Empire, Immaculate, Late Night with the Devil. We also have interviews for that very movie coming out on the show very soon. X-Men 97, and to throw in a little bit of a different genre, we're also going to have a review of Roadhouse. I'm your host, Jeff Ewing. I'm a critic, journalist, writer, host of this amazing podcast, and thank you so much for stopping by. First up, I want to talk about Ghostbusters Frozen Empire, which pops into theaters March 22nd. The monster in this case is Garaka. Early reports referred to it as the death chill, but that's just a thing that it can do, if you will, take things to absolute zero. Garaka is a powerful ancient god, basically, that was betrayed in the service of an early king, and its horns were cut off, and it was disempowered and put inside a brass sphere, one that you probably have seen from the trailers. Once again, the movie follows the Spangler family, who in this instance actually returned to the New York firehouse that Ghostbusters fans know and love. They team up with original Ghostbusters to get to the bottom of this new threat. They tour a new Ghostbusters storage facility that Winston had been working on in the background and come across the brass spherical artifact that exhibits a strong pull and control over emergent ghosts. We find out that it contains an ancient deity with a connection to a potential realm of the afterlife, and it threatens to engulf the entire world and everything in it in complete absolute ice, making the world basically overrun and fit for only ghosts. So there are definitely things that I liked about the film. You know, you'll see some folks reacting online about nostalgia bait or certain elements being criticized for being too whimsical, trying to like call back the originals and our love for the originals too much. Honestly, I liked those moments. As a fan of the franchise, I don't feel there was so much nostalgia bait that it actually detracted from the film. It ties into a lot of cute jokes and little one-shots and nods, and I found them in general charming. Series leads all work really, really well. I'd say Paul Rudd works probably the best. It's nothing that you haven't seen from him before. It kind of feels like Scott Lang at parts, but he has good dynamic with Carrie Coon. He has nice interactions and chemistry with McKenna Grace as performers, as family. Finn Wolfhard's Trevor is fine. You know, the character kind of is awkward and standoffish, and it's a little, you know, honestly, the way that it's written is a little bit much at times, but it's supposed to be. Kumail Nanjiani is a welcome addition to the cast. We see Patton Oswalt in a memorable scene, and it's literally always good to see him. By and large, they have good chemistry and gel together as a cast. The jokes, as I mentioned, you know, work more often than not. It's certainly charming. The comedy elements of the film as a horror comedy are probably the best parts of it. I would say that, you know, in essence, it's a charming film. It is not without its lovely moments if you're a fan of the franchise. Where I would say I have criticisms, it is a much slower film than I expected. It to get to actual the build up the threat of this apparently apocalyptic entity, it takes a really, really long time. There's not that much action in large segments of it, or that many scares for a franchise that or at least started out as horror comedies, even if they leaned more comedic. The actual villain doesn't really manifest outside the brass sphere until very late in the film, and then is relatively dispatched kind of easily. In essence, that leads for a very anticlimactic ride, if you will. I mean, the ghost elements are kind of few and far between, so if they don't work, that's literally in the title of the thing. They're very, very important. It is an interesting new villain, but I don't know, not unique or evolved or utilized well enough. It really kind of hampers the other elements of the film. There are also some logical issues that don't entirely make sense. For example, there's a character that there's a ghost that turns ally. I won't give away too much, but they need fire. I'm editing as to not spoil everything. They need fire to accomplish a goal, and this character happens to have like a ghastly match on themselves, and they use and need to use the ghastly match for a particular situation, but the ghost is also covered in constant ethereal or spectral flames. So that should have just solved the crisis. And this isn't just like a flames that are like a nice part of a design. They spend time talking about and explaining the ethereal flames that the character is perpetually covered in. It's a literal plot element that they take the time to have dialogue about, and it would solve the crisis, and it's almost as though they kind of forget that. It's a lot of just little nitpicky things like that where certain things could be tighter, they could be, you know, more developed, they could be scarier, they could be just stronger in general, and it's a lot of little issues or logical problems like that weigh it down ultimately. Altogether, Ghostbusters Frozen Empire shines in comedic and nostalgic moments, but it's too slow. They underutilize both ghosts in general and the villain, and it's a little too little thought out to ultimately land. Altogether, I give it 3 stars out of 5, and it releases in theaters March 22nd. Next, we have Immaculate, the Sydney Sweeney star. You know, it's in its essence a nunsploitation movie about immaculate conception of a kind. I won't say who the monster is, that'll spoil the ending. But it's directed by Michael Mohan from a script by Andrew Lobel. Sydney Sweeney plays Cecilia, an American nun who's very devout, and she travels to a remote Italian parish to live there and be a nun there. She's welcomed very warmly, but then things start to get a little bit strange, and she finds herself getting receiving immaculate conception. She's pregnant, though she's never had sex, and she's revered as the recipient of a miracle. But then things continue to get strange, scary, shady. So Immaculate is, it's relatively simple. It's lean and mean. A little bit slow in the buildup at times, but there's very little lulls where nothing is happening. It's more just about splitting hairs. As a whole, the cast works really, really well. Sydney Sweeney, it's clearly a star vehicle for her. And the movie confirms exactly what I've long said about her as an actress so far, which is that she really, really shines the more intense an emotion is for a character. If it's grief, if it's rage, if it's fear, the more high octane the emotion, the better her performance. And you really, really see that here. Once her, when it's just the mundane greeting the people in the new parish and dealing with daily life, she's fine. She doesn't give a moment of a bad performance, but it really hits a notch or two or three up as things escalate. And of course they do, because it's a horror movie. The ideas by and large are not necessarily novel. It doesn't 100% feel, if you've seen a lot of nunsploitation-y sort of horror, it's not gonna hit all new notes for you. So a lot of it will feel very familiar, although it goes to some interesting places. Where it really shines is in the third act, when things start to go off the rails. The actual final 10 minutes are incredibly memorable. And the very, very, very last scene is an all-timer for her. Definitely good notes to go out on. And if what you're looking for is something that swings for the fences, it definitely hits a homer on the final, 5 to 10 minutes. There, because of the lack of novelty of a lot of it, it feels very overly familiar. I'd say the first two acts kind of, simply they retread territory that you've seen a lot. I'd give this about 3.5 out of 5 stars, but I would definitely recommend it for the final act alone. Immaculate releases March 22nd in theaters. You'll be able to see it anywhere. The next film is kind of appropriately paired with Immaculate. It's Late Night with the Devil, which is written and directed by Colin and Cameron Cairns. It follows a late night host, Jack Delroy, who's a Johnny Carson rival. He hosts a syndicated talk show called Night Owls that's been, it's the show after the show. It's one to watch random stuff late at night. He has a tragedy, and his ratings continue. They never quite catch up to Johnny Carson, his rival, and they get increasingly strained after a tragedy that he suffers. So the character does a Hail Mary, and on October 31st, 1977, Jack plans a Halloween special where a reportedly possessed young girl is basically put on camera, and they're going to try and coax a demonic manifestation out of her live on air. So the star in this, Jack Delroy, is played by David Dalmachian, who, for fans of the show and for genre fans in general, is basically a legend. If it's a genre movie of any consequence, he's probably in it. He's been in loads of horror movies. He's been in Dune. He never gives a bad performance. And here is no different. He plays a Jack with complexity and charm and desperation and menace at times. And it's a wonderful performance. It's a great star vehicle. The thing that's most fun to watch about Late Night with the Devil, as things escalate, all the different the different layers of escalation and where there's a manifestation or where there's an effect, they all work really, really well. It's filmed in an intentionally nostalgic manner. It looks like you're watching, you know, the last tape performance of a show from the late 70s. So they nail that by using period lighting, by using stationary cameras, by using a lot of production details that and costuming and set design that really just kind of contribute to that feel of a found episode from the past. It's a great time. As things escalate and the tension builds, you really get a sense of growing dread, and the final 10 minutes are very cosmic horror-esque. They get, I'm not going to spoil anything because it's a good ride to take, but it ends in some really surprising ways that are well set up, but it harkens in some ways back almost to In the Mouth of Madness. Like, you'll really enjoy it. See it in a theater. It will be coming to, so it premieres theatrically on March 22nd, but it'll be streaming on Shudder April 19th. It's good as a streaming vehicle, but it's even better with an audience. Go in as blind as possible and just take the ride. Altogether, Late Night with the Devil is a creative and simple horror ride that weaponizes nostalgia well, with a great lead performance and a really lovely sense of awe and dread. Ultimately, I'll give Late Night with the Devil 4.5 stars out of 5. For our next review, I'm going to actually look at a TV series. Today, X-Men 97, the animated series, premieres on Disney Plus. I got to, fortunately, I got to attend the LA premiere of the first 3 episodes. It's a direct continuation of the original animated series, which I grew up with, which I really, really, really always appreciated, and also which happens to contain one of the best theme songs of all time. So X-Men 97, obviously it's done by new creators in a new era, but they go straight back to that animation style. They try and actually, like, it's almost a direct continuation of as if that series never ended. But, you know, you'll notice little small tweaks and shines here and there where even though it's a similar animation style and character design, there'll be little modernizations in the plot, little tweaks, bells, whistles. Altogether, you know, not to spoil what happens, but there are it takes some surprising turns and it sets off in some surprising directions. Things move very, very quickly. I'd say the 3 episodes that I watched so far are extremely promising, although a little uneven. The first episode was good, but not great. Kind of meandered in relevant moments. The subsequent 2, every episode was better than the prior one, with the second episode being very, very, very good, and the third episode being stellar at a fundamental level. So I look forward to seeing where the series goes. I think they really captured the feeling and the virtues of the animated series with some of the past, with some interesting flourishes. I'd give X-Men 97 4.5 stars out of 5. So far, the only thing keeping it from a straight 5 is, I mean, one, I haven't seen all the episodes, but also there's a little unevenness, although once it gets into its groove, it's great. It's absolutely worth your time. Finally, I want to take a second to visit with a decidedly non-monster movie, the action throwback Roadhouse. It's directed by Doug Liman, written by Anthony Begarozzi, Charles Mondry, and Chuck Mondry. In this Roadhouse, it follows the same premise, but it's a little more, it reorients Dalton, in this case Elwood Dalton, as a UFC fighter, an ex-UFC fighter. He's a former UFC middleweight who ends up working at a roadhouse in the Florida Keys that is strangely always beset by destruction by a local biker gang and local criminals. They hire him to sort of be a very proactive bouncer, and he comes to find out that there's a reason why the roadhouse is particularly subject to violence. Jake Gyllenhaal is really good as Elwood Dalton. I mean, he definitely pulls the range of necessary aggression. You have someone with a, you have a character that has a lifetime of violence behind him and a bit of a dark past, we come to find out. So he tries unsuccessfully to use violence as little as possible, despite being extremely proficient at it. You know, it's a complexity in action character that Gyllenhaal really pulls off well. And when it comes to the actual aggressive, you know, moments or the fight sequences and whatever, he handles that as well too. It's definitely believable. He has a lot of chemistry with Jessica Williams, who plays Frankie, the owner of the Roadhouse. She's good in it. She's really solid. All the supporting cast, Lucas Gage, also very good. Billy Magnuson does a good job as a more villainous character in Ben Brandt. Conor McGregor plays Knox. He is a antagonist that, you know, uses combat prowess instead of brains like Ben, and you know his name is Knox because he has it tattooed on his body. You know, he does a good job playing a violent and destructive nemesis, if you will, almost like the film's structured almost like a video game where Knox is in a sense a final boss. He does that really, really well. There's some funny bits with his character. He drives around a lot, and every time he gets behind the wheel, Knox, he goes as fast as possible, and then we only ever see him stopping a vehicle by crashing into things and then getting out like he doesn't care. And it happens at least 3 times. It's actually pretty funny in the way that they do it. I know Conor McGregor is a deservedly controversial figure, but he works well for the character. It's written for a person. It's either written for him or written well for a person like him. So it genuinely works here. The action choreography of the sort of acrobatically martial artsy but gritty bar fights are good. It's really, really good execution. Doug Liman is great as a director. He knows what he's doing with action sequences, and it's simple, it's gritty, it's not too needlessly stylized. So it's ultimately, you know, Roadhouse isn't going to win any Oscars, but for narrative, but it's not a stirring drama, but the performances work, the fight choreography works. It's fun. It's a fun, gritty action movie. I'd give it 3.5 out of 5. You know, it is only what it's trying to be and nothing else, and that counts ultimately. It knows exactly the movie that it is, and knows exactly what the audience wants. And how do you penalize a movie for that? Well, you have a number of movies come to theaters that are worth your time, and that are premiering on streaming. either now or in the near future. Thank you so much for spending some time with me and with the show, and hopefully this gives you a little bit of a guide in our media landscape as to the things that should be on your radar. And last but not least, stay tuned for our interview with the with Colin and Cameron Cairns, writer and director of Late Night with the Devil. That'll come out soon. Once more, I'd like to extend a special thanks to our guests this episode and to all of you out there listening. From the dawn of recorded human civilization, we've been fascinated by monsters and the monstrous. They've inhabited our dreams and nightmares, they've been our protectors and our villains, they've symbolized our fears and vices, our hopes and potential. Fears of creatures and the night that nourishes them were key inspirations and fuel for the rise of human civilization, the need to get out of the shadows, behind the walls, and into the light. In many ways, understanding our monsters is an important part of understanding our world and ourselves. So thank you for taking this journey with us, we humanoids from the Deep Dive.